Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The life of political prisoner and award-winning journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal remains in danger as prison authorities in Pennsylvania are slow to provide him with appropriate medical treatment. Abu-Jamal's blood sugar had reached dangerously high levels, indicating a diabetic condition that seemingly appeared out of nowhere. And his skin shows evidence of a serious condition as well. Relatives and supporters who managed to visit him in prison in late April reported that he is weak and barely able to walk and talk. This morning, the organization Prison Radio reported that medical staff at the Pennsylvania Correction Center informed Mumia that they were going to proceed with the first of several diagnostic tests recommended by his doctor and that a skin biopsy was done on Monday. But conditions remain about testing delays and inadequate medical care. The vibrant reporter who has been behind bars for more than 30 years and who just celebrated his 61st birthday in prison has shone a light on prison conditions through his insightful commentaries. But more often than not, his journalistic work focuses on the social and political issues of the day, both national and international. Mumia Abu-Jamal has managed to do inside prison what most people outside have never achieved. He's written more than half a dozen books, starting with his groundbreaking 1996 work, Live from Death Row. Now, in just a few weeks, City Lights Books will publish his newest work, Writing on the Wall, Selected Prison Writings of Mumia Abu-Jamal. The book has a foreword by Dr. Cornel West and has been edited by my guest, Dr. Johanna Fernandez, a professor of history at Baruch College of the City University of New York, a former Fulbright scholar, one of the coordinators of the campaign to bring Mumia home. Welcome to Uprising, Dr. Johanna Fernandez.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, in the foreword to the book that you edited, Dr. Cornel West calls Abu-Jamal a, quote, black prophetic voice. What does he mean by that, as far as you know?
Well, part of what Cornel West means is that if you look at the history of the United States, there are voices that have historically been uncompromising in speaking truth to power. Those voices have emerged out of the black experience, because the black experience, the institution of slavery and racism, really speak to the contradictions in American society, its promise of democracy and the reality of injustice, slavery, and racism. And these voices include Frederick Douglass, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Angela Davis, Dr. Martin Luther King, and many others. They are voices that are radical, uncompromising, and aspire to address the radical, the roots of black oppression.
Now, last year, the Pennsylvania legislature passed a law after Mumia recorded a commencement address for Goddard College. And the law is called the Revictimization Relief Act, which claims that victims of violence are re-victimized when the alleged perpetrators of that violence, who are convicted and imprisoned, speak out from behind bars. Mumia challenged this law in court, and just days ago, a federal judge struck it down. How important is this victory, not just for Mumia, but prisoners everywhere?
This is a tremendously important victory. The judge who declared the law unconstitutional said that the law was manifestly unconstitutional, that free speech must be practiced in this country, even when it comes to prisoners. Now, the reason why this is important is because there is an emerging movement in this country against mass incarceration. Without the voices of prisoners articulating how their cases were mangled in the courts, without these prisoners talking about solitary confinement and the horror that is imprisonment in the United States, the movement against mass incarceration wouldn't be where it is today. So this law was an attack not just on Mumia and his right to speak, but on the rights of all people, and prisoners in particular, who are especially vulnerable because they are behind the wall, and it's very difficult for American citizens to get a sense of what's happening in that sphere of life.
Right, and this isn't the first time that Mumia has legally challenged these sorts of laws that are trying to snuff out the voices. How have other prisoners in general also been encouraged to speak out by the work that Mumia has done? He's recorded thousands of commentaries over the years, and the group that works with him, Prison Radio, now features dozens of prisoners who are also speaking out.
Well, I think that one of the examples that has inspired other prisoners to speak out was Life from Death Row, Mumia's bestseller written in the 1990s, which humanized death row from the inside. We live in a society that dehumanizes prisoners. And for prisoners to see their stories told from a humanistic perspective inspired them to speak out. So Mumia has become known, as you know, as the voice of the voiceless. And what was encouraging about this latest battle was that the ACLU joined the suit and recruited quite a number of Pennsylvania prisoners whose writings would have been shut down had this law prevailed.
Let's talk about the book coming out soon, a gathering of many of Mumia's short essays over the years. You write in the introduction that initially in his prison journalism career, Mumia spoke about his case a lot. Of course, that's quite natural. But then he sort of transitioned to begin speaking out about other issues and analyzing both foreign and domestic policy issues and his own case less and less. Can you talk about that sort of evolution in his work?
Right. So this volume is important because it has within it important and rare writings that were produced early on during Mumia's imprisonment as early as 1982, in which he unequivocally declares his innocence. Mumia was embattled in the courts. He faced a trial that attempted to demonize him. The Fraternal Order of Police has held a long-standing 33-year campaign of demonization and criminalization. And at some point, Mumia, looking at the crisis of incarceration around him as it was growing before his eyes, because he was imprisoned during the period of massive growth in this industry, he turns his gaze away from himself and to the crisis he sees before him. But also, very importantly, he begins to write about and offer a Black radical counter-narrative to the ideology of the ruling class that presided over attacks on the gains of the civil rights movement, the political empowerment over the last 40 years of the 1%, and the deployment of terrorist wars abroad. So this volume really offers a new generation of Black radicals and activists across the country who are being galvanized by the crisis in Ferguson, in Baltimore, but also the transfer of wealth from the bottom of society to the top, the kind of activism that we saw during the Occupy movement. This book offers that generation of activists a way of contextualizing the crisis we're in today and how we got here.
Right, and that's a really important point. How well does Mumia Abu-Jamal's case, the persecution that he faced, the reactions that has that have come from the Fraternal Order of Police, his imprisonment, et cetera, fit within today's framework of oppression described by the increasingly popular catchphrase that Black Lives Matter? His case began in the 1980s.
Right. So all of the violations in Mumia's case, discrimination in jury selection, blatant racism on the part of the judge who presided over the case.
And even police brutality, right? He was beaten badly during the time of his arrest.
Absolutely. The fact that the police tampered with evidence to obtain a conviction and that he was beaten within an inch of his life on the night that Officer Faulkner was killed and was hospitalized for weeks as a result of this beating. This is the same crisis of police malfeasance that we see over and over and over again, and that intensifies over the last 40 years with the militarization of the police. Mm-hmm. And the Fraternal Order of the Police, which is the institution that has tried to get him killed, is the same institution, the Fraternal Order of Police, that is trying to influence what's going on in Baltimore today.
Right. Now, let's talk about the fact that Mumia's commentaries on social and political issues here in the U.S. have had a very long trajectory, simply because he's been imprisoned for so long. In the essays collected in the book, he not only critiques Ronald Reagan's economic policies, he covers the Rodney King beating and the trial of the LAPD officers, and Clinton's tough on crime policies, and so much more. In his writings, do we see clearly see the way in which specific U.S. policies over the last several decades have taken us to the place we are today?
Absolutely. One of the things that Mumia analyzes, which is important for us today, is the manner in which Black elected officials have been assigned to preside over an urban crisis of epic proportion that has created mass unemployment of African Americans, but also Latinos, and that has therefore required a police force to enforce social control and to warehouse a population that is redundant. So he is one of the social critics who, as early as the 1980s, is looking at the role of Black officials and the manner in which Black elected officials, like Obama, have successfully derailed movements from below. And what he argues is that change in society can only come about when people engage in uprisings as the ones we've seen in Ferguson and Baltimore. But part of what he argues throughout this volume is that organization and a deep understanding of society, its problems, and its root causes is critical to a strategic deployment of our political power from the grassroots.
Now, Dr. Johanna Fernandez, the 30th anniversary of the Philadelphia bombing of the Move House, this organization founded by John Africa, is coming up next week. And we often hear Mumia ending his commentary saying, "Long live John Africa." He writes about John Africa in the book. First, tell us who John Africa was, and then also how serious and undercovered an issue was the government bombing of the Move House in Philadelphia, where 11 people, including 5 children, were essentially killed by the government.
Well, John Africa was the leader of the MOVE organization, an organization that emerges in Philadelphia in the 1970s. Just as the civil rights and Black Power movements are declining, this organization is kind of a back-to-nature organization. It's urban, it's Black. And it is determined to challenge the aggression of the police that is building up in Philadelphia, but across the country in the aftermath of the Black Power movement. The MOVE organization is hated by the establishment in Philadelphia because it is unrelenting in its critique. It's militant. And Mumia Abu-Jamal is one of the few journalists in Philadelphia who want to tell the story of MOVE from the perspective of its members. They too have been demonized and criminalized by the Philadelphia mayor, by the police, and by the establishment in its totality. And on May 13th, 1985, there's a battle between the police and the MOVE organization. The police wants the MOVE organization to relinquish its home in Philadelphia. The MOVE organization decides that it has the right to remain where it is. And the police, alongside of the fire department and the Black mayor, drop a military-grade bomb on the move house that burns an entire African-American neighborhood. Over 61 homes are burned down to the ground. And this is, you know, an urban Holocaust of epic proportion that is understudied, that few Americans know about. And Mumia writes about this urban Holocaust in one of his essays that is published here in this book. And he says that the Middle East has its Sabra and its Shatila, and Philadelphia has the MOVE bombing. He writes eloquently about the tragedy of this moment, but what it means about the growing violence of state power in the post-civil rights and Black movement eras.
Now, I'm so glad you brought up the comparison that you did, because one of the things that has been so spectacular and important about his commentaries, and one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why our program has aired his commentaries, is his foreign policy analysis and its connection to domestic policy. Among the essays that he has in this book that he has just published or is about to publish are just comparisons between the conduct of the Iraq War by the United States, the similarity of treatment of Iraqi prisoners in Abu Ghraib with prisoners here in the United States. And that's an analysis that we don't see often enough.
Absolutely. Part of what he argues is that the horror that we saw at Abu Ghraib would not have been possible had that kind of dehumanization and systematic abuse of human rights not been practiced on American soil against American prisoners, a disproportionate number of whom are African American and Latino. So part of what he says is that the guards and soldiers who deploy terror against Iraqis at Abu Ghraib were previously employed in prisons in the United States. And part of what he argues, I think brilliantly, is that the kind of occupations we see in Palestine are the same occupations we see in neighborhoods like Baltimore. And without understanding that systematic deployment of state violence by the police and by an increasingly militarized police force, we don't understand the ferocity of Baltimore and the rebellion from below. And as we've seen, images of young people throwing rocks at police in Baltimore were comparable to young Palestinians throwing rocks at the military, at the Israeli military, during the Intifada.
And of course, similar demonization of both groups of young people in the media. You point out in your introduction, finally, that although the state has relentlessly persecuted Mumia for over 33 years, painting him as a hardened and hateful killer, his voice is without bitterness. And you're right, I've noticed that too. And why do you think that is?
You know, it's one of the conundrums, because if you study Mumia's case and you study the manner in which the Fraternal Order of Police has relentlessly demonized him and influenced the court process in his case and the appellate process, you scratch your head and ask, how is this man able to retain his humanity? And the sense of profound love that pulses through his commentaries. And part of what Mumia says is that the incredible amount of support and love he feels daily from letters written to him by his supporters from around the world has sustained him. But I think that his clear analysis of the problems in the United States and the world over, his critique of capitalism and empire have allowed him to sustain a steady voice. And his study of social movements have allowed him to hope continue to fight for the highest aspirations of society. So I think that's what sustains him.
And finally, how important is it for people to call on the Pennsylvania Corrections Department to demand that he either be given appropriate medical treatment, which it sounds like they might be slowly starting to do now, or to simply demand that he be released in order to get good treatment? How important is it for that continuing call to go out?
Mumia Abu-Jamal is dangerously ill. I visited with him this Sunday. And even though he was able to walk, for the first time in a long time, he still remains very weak. He walks very slowly, and he still is in a lot of pain. But most importantly, his skin condition has worsened. And what I noted during the visit is that he did not stop shaking over the course of the 4 hours that I was with him. So Mumia remains dangerously ill. And I personally think that there is an attempt at a public execution of Mumia Abu-Jamal on the part of the state. Mumia is a dangerous voice, especially in this moment of upheaval. His voice represents a continuity in struggle from the 1960s and the Black Power movement to today, and the lessons of those struggles. That is very dangerous in this moment when we are seeing such pretty open challenges to the police and state power, as we've seen in Baltimore. So I do not think that the state is for a moment going to give Mumia the specialized care that he needs. His doctors at the prison infirmary finally told him that they thought that his skin condition was eczema, but now they have no idea what it is. If they have no idea what it is, he needs to be transferred immediately to a hospital that is capable of really diagnosing these pretty horrific symptoms that he has.
Well, Dr. Johanna Fernandez, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and shedding some light on the ongoing story of this remarkable human being.
Thank you very much for covering the story.
Dr. Johanna Fernandez is a professor of history at Baruch College of the City University of New York, a former Fulbright scholar, one of the coordinators of the campaign to bring Mumia home, and the editor of the new book, Writing on the Wall. We'll turn next to a short recording that Prison Radio just did with Mumia Abu-Jamal. It's his latest piece out on April 26th, and it's called Message to the Movement.
Dear friends, dear brothers, sisters, comrades, I thank you from the bottom of my heart for the love you have shown me and continue to show me from all around the world. Hundreds, perhaps thousands of people called, wrote, came out, protested, demonstrated. I did not know that many of you were there because I was not conscious for some of that time. I did not see you. I did not hear you, but I felt you in my heart. I felt you in my bones. I feel you now. And I thank you. I am not back to where I was before, but I will be, thanks to you, and thanks to the love you've radiated to me. I love you all, not just this word. I love you all from the bottom of my heart. On the move. Long live John Africa, and we shall prevail. From Imprisoned Nation, this is your brother, Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And Mumia Abu-Jamal just recorded this message to the movement in late April. This is Uprising. After this break, we'll be joined in studio by Terrence Fitzgerald discussing his new books. Stay tuned.